so. So I wanted to correct the exercise, but I didn't manage it still. So any progress? Any progress with the exercise, was correcting the second exercise.
Austin told you about a few other things, didn't he?
Yes, okay. But I corrected two of them, but not the third one, about the binary search. So yeah, that can be corrected also, but I need to do a relationship or something else. We can make a routine, can't you call it? If the binary search is not okay. Search in a binary tree. Alright. Yeah, apart from that, that was okay. I mean, we were remarks to the point. So concerning the second assignment, I proposed the deal that we basically remove this short part of the second and the first. Well, the portion of the first part of short, because I mean partly this was wrong. I mean this contained a typo which was relevant for solving it. To me, it makes sense, but if you're not very comfortable with it, that you can get stuck with this formulation, and then it's not clear how to fix it, etc. And it's also more demanding than this first two ideas. So I mean the short part of the size two. So for me, the point of this exercise was like to take like the most simple example possible and calculate the denotational semantic and like put your hands on something. But even if it's such a simple example, it turns out to be still demanding, right? So one can do it, but. I understand that it's not appreciated. And concerning this first and the second part, I think they are pretty doable. So I think we'll still do this second part of exercise today. And concerning the exercise 3, yes, also. So the verification of the sort mode law is kind of can be lengthy if you do it in all details. So I'm also going to not include it into the assignment into the grade for this assignment, meaning that just everyone received these points. Any questions about further questions about exercise assignment 3? So I've tried to respond to criticism and make it not so difficult. So is it like okay complexity? Yes. Okay. I know your opinion, but maybe the other ones.
We'll see.
Yeah. So you didn't start yet. What about you?
I didn't start yet because.
Yeah, so I appreciate a lot if you start earlier and then communicate the errors to me, which I didn't fix, and sometimes there are still typos. But if it's done at the very last moment, then... So, I don't know, any other feedback? I want you to have some feedback. Yes?
So, in the first exercise in the new sheet?
Yes.
Ink has the search argument.
Can you show it to me because I didn't print it out?
The search argument that uses.
Yeah, and it also doesn't fit into the usage of these.
Oh, you correct it.
Yes, yes, that was the correction from yesterday, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I there's just a mathematical tradition to omit the arguments to the unit constants, but of course it has been just from type. I didn't know why I skipped it. I programmed the solution, so I know that the solution exists. And, it's got a working program, but somehow maybe there was a copy-paste error.
And then I'm not sure in the third part what I should increment. When you mentioned you should increment before I run the first call, is that all?
No, you just call the ink, and yeah. Ink is supposed to do the job automatically.
When do they call the ink? Only before a recursive call?
Before a recursive call, like in that example. So every time you would just call it normally, you just prepend it with ink. And of course, it's a part of the exercise to comment the results, because. You would get some results, and now that you know how this monoidal, did they call it again? Monoidal module bond, so how it was the structure of it, so you can see why the program works like this and why you get these results.
What kind of comment do you expect?
Well, like interpret the results. You would run the program, you would have like a pair of an integer and this monad as a pair where first is number, so explain what this number is and the sense of this program. What we are calculating in the
Should we create a num instance for some int before there is not?
Well, there is one. That's part of that monoid implementation. Basically, the integers as a class of integers, but you can view them as a monoid. With respect to sum and with respect to multiplication.
Yeah.
So,
but for sum,
I think I programmed that.
So what you're claiming is that it's not included in the library, right?
That the sum mutator is referenced doesn't have a number instance.
Does it have a number instance?
Let's see.
Well, it works with me.
It has a num instance.
Maybe you have an old version of it.
Doesn't have in 7.6, but in 7.8.
Yeah, so you can either upgrade or program it. I think it's not very difficult to program. So, and about that LaTeX code that you're writing,
yes.
So you want to make it available?
Yeah, okay.
I mean, that's a question. Do you want to?
Yeah, sure.
And how much do you have already?
I have all the lectures, but I need to go over that a few times, maybe, because, as I said, the double speed.
So we could put it some place where we can jointly edit it, maybe, and invite it also.
It's currently on git.cs.fg. you please.
All right, no, it's nothing.
So maybe you send me an email. I don't know how we can like.
I mean, it's available here, and you can send it. Just my emails.
Okay. Could you summon me the thing?
Yes.
So I didn't do it like this. I don't know how complex it is. I mean, how practical it is in sense of joint work.
I don't know if you know the workflow. It's pretty simple.
Yeah. Is it just like standard Git? Like I could work it in GitLab? Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, you won't have push access to this repository, but you can send me the patches or just open them.
So sending a patch doesn't mean that I like write an email. It means that I run some code and it would generate a patch which would receive and approve.
Yeah, Git has a command called set email, which just sends patches.
Alright. Yeah, I usually do everything in SVN because I'm not developing it. Using it for editing papers, and so SVN is sufficient for that. So I don't know, maybe someone would be interested in that too. Okay, any other issues we want to discuss? So next time I will not be available, meaning next lecture, not the practicals, but the lecture. I will be off, so I will send Christopher who will probably tell you about nation transformations and give some examples. And give an alternative definition of format, which was requested previously, but which I didn't manage to give yet, so probably he will do it. So, okay. And then I propose to. Propose to stick to that example with so the first part of exercise 3. So when I started it previously, and I have thought about how to present it concisely. Indeed, it's not so simple. There are different solutions. Basically, there are different strategies you can apply. Straightforward strategy, which I received as a solution, by the way, was to apply projections. So if you want to prove that P is equal to Q, where this, let's say F and G, so, and these are two functions from A to BC. So then they are equal if and only if you compose with the first projection and the results are equal, compose with the second projection, the results are equal. So this is if and only if. And this is easy to prove. That's just two words. Lemma. I gave you a complete system of axioms for Cartesian categories, well, for categories of products. And they are complete in the sense whatever is true, you can derive from them. and in particular to prove this lemma. So let's just put it in, well, actually, this direction is trivial, right? If the things, two things are equal, then you take projections and the results are equal. So we need to prove the other direction. So suppose you have the right hand side and you prove the left hand side. And how you do it? Well, you start with F and you sequentially apply the loads. Which way around? Yes. You sequentially apply the loss that you have, so it's just pure equational reasoning. You start with F, and this is equal to that because of the xn of the category. And then there is a law like this, PR1, PR2. Can close this F, which I showed in the lecture. And then we can pull this F inside, PR1. F, PR2, F, right? And then you can use your assumption. So you can replace each side with the same, but with G. And now you can do everything in the reverse direction and get G. Right, so this is a simple lemma, which is probably intuitively understood, but it's easy to prove formally because there are all laws, all of them available, and that easily follows on them. There are many other auxiliary things which are also sort of intuitively clear, but which also follow. For example, we said that we have this notation fg equal to pr1 f and pr2 g. No. F PR1 and G PR2. So that was by definition. And it goes from A1 times B1 to A2 times B2. So, and again, you can use this for loads to prove things like F times G, composed with F prime, G prime. This is F, G. So you can prove lots of things like this. This means that if you compose this two constructions, then you compose them component-wise. Because this applies to left only, that argument only, this only to that argument. And so then you can also have something more general, like F times G, composed with a pair F1 G1. So this returns us a pair, and we apply F to the left component of the pair and G to the right component. This is the same as dragging this F and G inside of this angle brackets. is it intuitively clear that this works? Because there are like dozens of these laws, and I cannot enumerate all of them, but for solving exercises like this, you need to have an intuition about them and see how they appear. And of course, then you can prove every of these laws formally. So, and one strategy for solving this exercise was like you have this this question f star g star f is equal to f star g star. So you replace it by these two clauses pr1 g star equals pr1. Star G star. And then you can simplify it. And in the first clause, you would get stuck at some point, but then you would see that the result is again a pair, so you can apply this trick again. So, and this goal, you would again have two sub-goals, and then every of the sub-goals would resolve. So that's a strategy. If you have to prove something about products, then if you don't know what to do, you just apply this lemma, and something will hopefully simplify. Because if you apply projections, they would interact with the expressions inside and maybe kill something. So, but I, as I said, this is a solution which I received here. But I can show you another solution. So, and basically, one can draw a big diagram. So we can explain the idea of why it's like this. So we need to start with this thing and eventually obtain something like A times Z, where we've got f going from x to m times y, and g going from y to m z. So that's the object we start with, and this is the object which we end up with. And somewhere in the middle, we apply f and g and the associativity. So and basically, this the equality says that we can apply it to different orders, but the result is the same. So I just try to connect these two things with the sort of order, and then I will try to reduce it to this on the one hand and to that on the other hand. So, but what the idea, I basically want to shift the applications of f and g as soon as possible, to apply them as soon as possible. So I just apply f to x, so I would have m times y, and then immediately I want to apply g. So here I do id times g. Yeah. So I've tried to apply f and g right one after another. Why? Because I want to three occurrences of m, because I know that I have a law for three times m. Three for a project with three M's in a row. So, and right now, if I want to join this with my target, basically, I have two ways to do it. I can apply multiplication to this, and then multiply the result with that. And alternatively, I can apply the multiplication to this pillar first, and then to the result and the first component. That's precisely the trick with this identity, because in this identity, it's hidden that we can apply the monoidal multiplication in two different orders because of associativity. So we can first multiply these things and then multiply this and the result, or in the other order. So I want to reflect this situation in a diagram. So basically, I finish my diagram and want to finish my diagram in two different ways. So, and one way would be, well, first multiply these two components and then multiply the result with that one. I cannot do it immediately because I need to rearrange the brackets. So I first apply associativity alpha, and then I have this. And then I apply star times AD. So after applying the associativity, we get this. Right. So and now I can apply this star to this part and leave the second part intact. So I would have m star m times m times that. So this was the first step, and now now I would need an intermediate step, so an associativity law again. And I keep, so again, I keep the set and do the multiplication. So that was like one order when I multiply the first, this first two, and then the result is this order. And alternative route would be to do it in the other direction. So I first apply the associativity to this. So I would have this. M times M times that, and apply my multiplication inside the brackets. So here I have ID times star times ID. Right. So and now I can finish this diagram easily because just for the same reason. So this I can collapse in the same way. So I apply alpha. Hit m times m times that, and m star times a. So now we can compare it to, well, first we need to show that this commutes, and I'm just expecting that it should commute because I applied my associativity and did it like in the same way the associativity law. There's a big diagram for why it does it, but I got like some junk data here like that, which just sticks around over time and didn't play any role. But intuitively, this should commute because we've got an associativity law which essentially states this thing. So I hope that this should commute. And before we prove it, we should compare this diagram to what we actually want to obtain. And what we want to obtain is, so recall by definition, F star is equal to star times ID times alpha times ID times F. So let's just rewrite these expressions. F star G, and that is just equal to ID alpha D times F star G. And that simplifies further. So here I've got what? I've got star times ID composed with alpha, composed with ID times F, and composed with G. So this all is inside of the sphere. So this pair function and this second function is just like this. And we can simplify it a little bit more because it's again one of the laws which we can prove about this operator, that if one of the component is a composition, then we can transform it to a composition of ID with the first one and ID with the second one. So this part we just rewrite. Alpha ID times star ID, star ID. So this is more or less clear. So then we transform the right hand side. And this is simpler because it just composes two compositions. Okay, and now I can try to compare it with what I have on the diagram. something is wrong, right? I think the orders of the functions is confused, basically. And the diagram is say that I apply G after F, and here I apply F after G. So F and G are confused here. So maybe just replace it somewhere like here. G. F. G.
Replace F star with G star or so.
I thought that
because for the equations you use F star is equal to star times ID times
yes.
etc. And
for G it's the same what was G?
Well for the equations you use it with F. So you for G it's the same.
Yes, except that you replace
F of G.
F by G, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not writing the equation for G because it's just the same.
Yeah.
Okay. But of course in these calculations every time I use the definition of the star. So I think, and now if you look at these two equations, two expressions, we need to prove that they are equal. And if you read this piece of the diagram, then you would have this expression. All right, you start with F, and then, so the difference between these equations is that from the equations you read from left to right, if you want to match to the pairs on the diagram, you need to read the pairs from backwards. So you need to, you should read the equation backwards. So you have F times ID, or ID times F. Here, ID times F. And ID times ID times G. And G times ID times G. And all the way via this pairs. So, and if you assume that the diagram commutes, then you would have equality of these two passes. But that's not sufficient because this pass is not equal to this expression. Right? You start with ID times F, but then you get star times ID, while here you've got ID times G. So this is the place where it diverges. So, and that's why you need to complete this diagram. Basically, you add this test that you need from this equation. The diagram with this pass, which would correspond to this expression. So now I have ID times F, and then alpha, and then star ID, and then ID times G, and then the rest, which is the same. And I also add this arrow between this and that. Because basically, if I just add up this pass, here I would have an additional cell in this diagram, and to prove that everything commutes, I would need to prove that this part and that part commutes. Because this is how you do this diagrammatic presence. You make a big diagram, and it contains cells. To make it, to say that, to prove that this diagram commutes, you need to prove that all these cells are commuting. Obviously, this implies this that the whole diagram commutes by like simple. That's called diagram chasing. So there's a term for that. Category theory: you prove things by diagram chasing. So you. And now, now if I have this big cell, I again can simplify it by splitting it to other cells, because now I see that I've got this thing and that thing, and it looks like just leaving this argument intact and applying G to the second one, so the type matches, and from the diagram which I obtained, I also like slightly see that this should commute, because here you do this associativity and then G to the component, this is a second component, and here if you also do G, apply G to the second component, and then associativity. So this is a certain candidate for commutativity. And yeah, indeed, you can easily prove that this commutes just by definition of Python. And the same kind of argument you apply here. So here you apply star to the second component, and then to the first component, G to the second, and here you do the same, but in the other direction. So you first apply G and then star, but since these branches are independent, it's expected that this diagram should commute. And it's again a very, very simple calculation. So now I'm essentially done with my equation. About a module of commutativity of this diagram, so which I postponed to the end. So how I prove it? So again, I just split it into other diagrams, and so my idea would be to split it like I'm not sure if I have enough room for it. So basically, I want to split it like this, n times m. Times M times that, and M times M and M times M times that. So I distinguish this pentagon diagram inside, because that's my associativity along which I want to apply. So if you just look at this diagram and compare it with the diagram which in the condition of the exercise, it's the same one, except that we add ID everywhere. So this must be huge. And then I distinguish that part, and then I complete the rest. And well, this is like what you obtain if you think about it. So because you want to connect this to that, because these two things are connected, because you just rearrange the brackets, so you apply alpha alpha, and here these are the same morphism modulo, put in brackets differently. And then the same thing you have here. So, and now the question is on the this diagram, which is not entirely obvious, but again, it should be intuitively clear why it's true. So there's only associativity involved. So you like get four components here, and you apply associativity to them, but in various orders. And that's something which I don't know what sort of mathematical courses you've got here. But in like group theory, that's the first thing that you learn. So there is associativity. That's why brackets do not matter. That's why you can emit them, because you can put them in some way, but you would always have the same result, because associativity tell you how to transform from one expression bracket in one way to expression bracket in a different way, and you may have different ways to do it, but that's not relevant. And this is exactly what you have in this diagram. So you rearrange the brackets in this expression to get this one, but you have gotten it in a different order. So this is intuitively clear, and what you can do to complete the proof is just to verify it by a plain calculation. So, but just since we are talking about it, I want to present you some piece of theory which is very simple, from which this diagram will follow, because in fact, what we see here, what we learn from this example, is the necessity of proving that things like this are commuting. And you do it really often. When you do this sort of arguments often, then you would have lots of diagrams which would contain cells with this kind of properties, and it's tedious to prove that they commute every time. So you need a general principle for this sort of arguments, and it's possible to formulate a principle. So I just cited for your information. So it's called Mach Lanes. But here is theory. And we just consider a simplified formal. So in general, it's formulated in more in extended settings, but the ones which we need here would be so the children version of this theorem. And then if we formulate it for our proposals, it would look like this. And the diagram. So So that's a very simple formulation. Basically, I just formalized this intuition that I roughly explained here, that if your diagram consists only of this associativity law, or it's also called associator, this alpha, and in the same way you can form an inverse of alpha. So I presented alpha as like encoding in terms of brackets and projections. In the same way you can create a map in the other direction. So alpha is actually an isomorphism which has an inverse, which one can call alpha. So you can take alpha, alpha minus 1, and times. So this this product constructor and the IDs, and no matter what diagram you compose out of it, as long as the diagram makes sense, of course. So it should be should include the transitions, correctness of which doesn't follow from the diagram itself. Then the diagram use. Okay, so is it all right, more or less? How's it better? How would you think about it?
I don't know.
Is it on the digestible too?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. But I agree with you, of course. It's, the whole problem of this is to develop it. Yeah. When you present it, it's not so difficult, but you need to design it. And but it's a it's as I said, you can prove different ways, and this is like a category theory book style proof. So that's how the people present proofs in mathematical papers. They say, well, the theorem follows from the following diagram, and then just show the diagram and you see, look at the diagram and see. So right, maybe let's consider somebody's program. Who wants to show the solutions to the first exercise? Maybe someone with a laptop. And with glasses. What about you?
Hast du mal für mich da?
If you design the program, then maybe you could give that percent. Even though you didn't have glasses, so it's okay. So can we see again?
Okay. Right. So
First, I define the data type here. It has two fields of the whatever type it should be. And I use the same constructor as complex in the SQL base libraries. And I think I'll start with the num instance because I use num in the other classes.
So I again, that's that was not correctly formulated, not entirely correctly formulated. So I've got this this clause that like ensure that SQR to non A is an instance of the following type process. That's probably it was in the next edition of this problem sheet where I denote like modulo suitable assumptions.
Yes, I think only with
EQ. Yeah, about then, yes, it's not quite free with this example next, because suitable assumption may actually mean that you need to strengthen this the right hand side of the implication.
The numeric operations are straightforward. Just evaluate it on paper, whatever, and then you compose the type again.
Yeah, so the plus and minus are straightforward, and the multiplication is not entirely straightforward, and I think some people get it wrong. Basically, because there were like cases where one just exported the definition for complex numbers, where it's different, and so one should, of course, capture the semantics of this kind of objects. So, and if you can, you maybe like make a small calculation. No, I meant that like let more proof that that this is a correct definition.
Then we have to evaluate of course, this is the second part of the data type.
So the modulo some base mass, you can get this, and you don't need any properties of this sort of numbers except that you've got plus and multiplication.
Right. To negate it, so I just negate both parts. And yes, this is the interesting part, I think. Both elements are larger than zero, then signum is of course one. If both are smaller than zero, it's minus one. And in the other cases, I basically calculate the difference between numbers and then build the type again.
So
if this is smaller than zero, which means the field, the second part is bigger than the first, and I take the signal, then I get minus one again, or one, or whatever. And abscess, signal times, signal x times x, from an integer, of course, I just put the part in the first element of the type. We can do Q now. I calculated the difference between types and check if it's zero or not. So if the difference is zero, then of course the types are equal. I had to do a signaling here because the components might not be zero, but the sum might be zero in the end. I'm not sure if this is actually correct or not. But yes, it's precise. In the signal here, I put a zero in the second part, so this has, the first has to be zero. The entire number is zero.
Well, the definition, so the definition was correct to me. So if what it calls is correct, I think that's also fine. Yeah.
Okay, and for odd, it's the same, only I didn't just check for zero, but if it's smaller or larger than zero. Mm-hmm. Yeah, fractionals, you do the same, like for multiplication. Should I also?
Yeah, I propose that's an interesting calculation. So what's your strategy here?
Well, I want to get rid of one of the roots.
Yes, but you want to get rid of them where the top of the bottom.
I want to get rid of the bottom, so I extend it to the bottom.
Yeah, precisely.
place, like this one.
Yeah.
Then,
so the trick is very similar to the one with complex numbers, but you just find an adjoint number to the denominator, and here the just adjoint is the primary function. Yeah, except that you confused plus and minus. So the first summand is minus 2 p1 plus 2. Yeah, because you multiply at square of 2 p1 and pi square of 2 p2. And also in the right component. Well, what you got in the program is actually correct.
Yeah, for get real, we have to basically calculate the value of this number, so we just use this definition.
Yeah. So the point, of course, is that if it's smaller, then you can calculate the square root. So it's not just a formal sign anymore, but it's actual number.
This is the first.
So can you run me some example? We can try something that we can check, like 1, 0, so it should produce the same number, I think.
Okay. Any questions?
Well, maybe just let's do the second exercise too. How about that? You got it, too.
Yeah, don't
you?
Yes. It's more like water. Okay. And first, I find the type. It just consists of the monad and the value, and the monoid and the value. For a functor, we don't care about the monoid part, we just apply f to the value and compose the type back together. For monad, in return, we use an empty for the monoid value. And for find, we decompose of the first type, and the important thing is to combine the monoid values here.
So you multiply. So this this was it, right?
There's nothing. There's nothing below.
So that's, that works fine. You don't need to specify any compiler or interpreter keys. That's probably because you have got an older version. So in the example that I published on the web page, so there was a key in the bracket saying that like produce no warnings about this functor mm not being applicative.
Oh, for the newest version, you don't even get a warning. It's an error.
It's an error, yeah. So that's something that I didn't know.
You can use the MOLAT functions in the applicative definition, so it's quite easy.
Yeah. Well, right. We didn't explain applicative function, but if you can do it, you just do it. I mean, I wanted to avoid that, and I wanted to use that that key for the compiler because I didn't want to discuss applicative functors. I didn't know that it's in some compiler versions it's not possible anymore. But basically, right, we have discussed functors and monads, and there is an intermediate thing which is like stronger than a functor but weaker than a monad, and so the new versions of Haskell insist that if you define something as a monad, then it also must be this applicative functor. So it's really not in the center of this course, but since we're doing Haskell, we should know about it. Maybe I ask Christoph to tell next time, and he will give you another example. But the point is, I don't quite remember, so I think the main part we never really used them. But for applicative functors, you need to provide an operation like f a times b times f a f b. Right? So, like, if you have a function under functor and an argument on the functor, then you can apply this function to an argument and stay inside the functor. So, if you have a monad, then you can always produce such a thing because, if f was a monad, so we would need to define this thing. F C A T B. So what was the symbol for it? This one, right?
Yes.
So you need to combine F with P, and this is what this is, I think. So I need something that takes, this is an argument, fx, and then I return So I need to generate something of type A to TB. So and I've got just A. And this. So
what are you trying to do? Because
I'm trying to define the thing using the monad, assuming that he's a monad.
But you don't need a monad because you already have P, that's just the second argument.
So what's the expression?
I think the definition should be in Haskell at least.
Yeah, I thought you can tell me. I'm trying to develop it now.
So F bind.
Hmm?
F bind operator.
This one.
Yes. Lambda. Something. Yes.
Lambda FT. Or P.
P tick, and then you can.
Again?
Yes. I'm just evaluating F and P. And then you can apply F to P and return the result. So return F applied to P. Tick, of course.
F to P applied to P tick, yes. I mean, yeah, this looks reasonable. I thought that maybe I can write it concisely just using the syntax with star and eta.
Yeah, right. We'll replace five by eta and the other way around, five by star.
Yeah, and then I think it probably can be simplified. But yeah, all right, so just maybe so I need to start from the inside. Something like this.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So you can do it. You can use a model structure to define an applicative functor, but not every applicative functor is a model. So that's why we have this intermediate clause. So, and in this case, you can give a direct definition, right? Which is what you're doing. Do you have an idea?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think
it's
okay. So there's also pure function which works the same way as a return pointer. Alright, so this f is my function encapsulated in the first argument, and a is an argument encapsulated in the second argument, and you just go under the constructor and apply function, the arguments and multiply the counters on these columns. Yeah, but of course you could do everything in the other direction, so you could, well, actually, in this version of Haskell, at least, you can first declare it to be a monad, and then declare it to be a functor using the monad operations.
Yeah,
so it doesn't check that you first define the functor. Yeah, okay. But again, one of the points of this example, again, which I emphasize in the statement, is that we start with a monad, and then we show part of the exercise was to show that a monad is a functor. And I hope this is something that you've done, because I think this is the easiest part of the exercise. But then, after you formulate the definition of that functor directly, you see that you do not need any longer to know that this thing was a monoid. Because if you look at the definition of this, to the definition belonging to the functor instance, then you do not use the monoid multiplication anymore. That's why you also do not need the assumption that f is a monoid, and which you do have here. And that's probably one, well, that's certainly one of the reasons why, so I think it's a very good example in the end, because it illustrates lots of things. So that you do not necessarily want to first declare something to be a monad and then just automatically derive the operation, because in this process you might do some simplification, like remove the assumption that about M being a monoid. So this sort of fine-grained differentiation is precisely what you can appreciate in the example like this. Okay. Thank you. So, any questions about this assignment, apart from those, from the third part of exercise 2, which we are not going to consider, just would take lots of time again. Exercise 3 are alright. I think the most difficult part was this sword equation for the moment. Right, and the rest was not so difficult. So any other questions about this problem sheet? Okay, so then probably just finished because we didn't start.